I'm talking now with David Sirota. David Sirota gets around a lot. He's an author. He's a syndicated columnist. He's you're working on a new book, I'm told. Or
yes.
It's out already.
I just finished.
You just finished the book.
It's going to be out on the end of May.
And the title of the book is?
The Uprising, an unauthorized tour of the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington.
The populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington.
Yeah.
Is Lou Dobbs behind all this? Or?
Well, it's definitely a look at both the right and left. I have a whole chapter on Lou Dobbs. I have a whole chapter.
He's got a whole chapter, huh?
Oh, yeah. Spent some time with him. Some of the things he said were, I think people will find newsworthy and fairly shocking in the book.
Then you got to tell us. What's he going to say? It's going to shock me. Let me guess. He's against illegal immigrants.
No, actually, he says that if a plan came up to raise legal immigration by 3 million people, he'd be all for it.
So his argument really is it's illegal, not that they're immigrants.
Yeah, and what's interesting about him saying that was...
Because that does surprise me,
that,
frankly.
Yeah, and what was interesting about him saying that, he really doesn't say that on the air.
No, he sure doesn't.
And I think, and I go into this in the book, that I think that the reason he doesn't say it is because it might potentially alienate some of his...
Fellow
who
travelers.
Who he believes are his viewers.
Well, of course.
That's right.
But... I thought it's all about protecting the working man's wages, isn't it? Isn't that what it's about for Lou Dobbs?
Yeah, and I think his case would probably be, now I'm speaking for him, but I think my guess is that he believes that legal immigration doesn't drive down wages in the way that illegal immigration
does. Because
we
get a better class of immigrant, more educated.
I think the theory is that if you're legal and you're in the system, the employers... are going to have to follow the law in employing you. An illegal immigrant, it's much easier to not follow the law. And by the law, I mean wage laws.
Sure, sure.
I
minimum wage, work safety.
Exactly. So I think that's probably why he said that. I'm guessing.
Wow, sounds like I agree with Lou Dobbs.
I'm telling you. And what's really interesting about, I think, about the chapter is that there's another issue. You know, he talks a lot about trade, NAFTA.
Right.
And he talks about a lot about immigration.
Right.
But he never connects the two. Now, the connection is that if you have a trade policy that impoverishes a country like Mexico or keeps it impoverished,
right.
That's going to create more pressure for people there to come over
but
the border.
NAFTA was supposed to help Mexico. If anything, it was impoverishing American workers to help Mexico.
Well, it was supposed to, but that's not the way it's worked. That's
it's hurt Mexico and America?
Absolutely, 100%.
How does it hurt Mexico?
It has hurt Mexicans because the final agricultural sections of NAFTA were just ratified a couple months ago. And that's why you saw mass protests in Mexico City about this. What ends up happening was, as just one example, NAFTA permitted our agribusinesses, which are huge agribusinesses. I'm not talking about the small farmer. I'm talking about ADM,
right,
which is hugely subsidized by the federal government, by our federal government, to come in and wipe out.
Through regular farm subsidies.
Through regular farm subsidies, which
give a lot of money to the bigger people.
That's right.
Right.
The money is actually targeted to the bigger a farmer you are.
Well, in fact, there was an amendment recently, a Democratic amendment, to say that if you earn, I forget what it was, $2 million or something dollars, then you can't get the subsidies.
That's
and, of
right.
course, they
it
shot
did,
it down.
Yeah, that's right. And so what ended up happening is that you've got hugely subsidized American corporate agribusinesses that go to Mexico and destroy the local farming economy. I mean, a small corn farmer in Mexico cannot compete with a subsidized ADM, for example.
Well, it's hardly free trade if we're subsidizing
exactly
agriculture.
Right. And so what ends up happening is that those farmers have gotten kicked off their land, moved to the cities, and many of them are the ones who are trying to come over the border looking for better jobs.
Let me compare Lou Dobbs. You also mentioned the Minutemen. Now, I take it they actually are quite, you would think they're allies with Lou Dobbs, but they really don't want any immigrants, right, legal or illegal.
That's exactly right.
They're nativists. They don't want that other culture in our land.
I think that's right. I think that, but I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I think what they feel, many of them that I've talked with, and I spent a lot of time with them, was their feeling was were based on national security fears. The national security fears and xenophobia have melded together.
But they're two completely different concepts, really. I mean, you can be all for diversity and say, well, I don't want terrorists to come here, but
That's
I'm okay
right.
with people that are different cultures.
But a lot of people believe that...
No one thinks the Mexicans are terrorists.
Wrong.
Wrong? They think the Mexicans are terrorists? I understand they take our jobs. I get that.
They believe they believe that Mexicans are that many Mexicans who come over the border are drug runners and drug cartels, and they liken drug cartels to terrorists. I mean,
it's pushing it, but okay, there are criminal, there are criminal elements. I'll accept that.
And P.S. many of them believe that Islamic terrorists are using the border, the open border, to come into the country. But they believe that very, very seriously.
But that's not true. I mean, I've seen those statistics.
You're exactly right. It has not been proven to be true.
I saw a statistic. How many people cross the border each year?
It's 12 million.
I think 12 million are here. No, it's not 12 million. I thought it was like 2 or 3 million.
I can't remember. I may be saying the number of actual border crossings that one person can... I mean, one person can go over five times.
Right.
So the question is how many crossings.
What I remember is that in the millions of crossings,
yes,
there was less than 300 people from countries that have been linked to Islamic terrorism. So in other words, people that cross the Rio Grande, you know, the great, great majority are from Mexico. A smaller number are from, you know, further south in South America.
That's right.
And if you look at, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or Iraq,
right,
or Palestinians or whatever, it was literally less than 0.01%.
You're exactly right. I mean, the only issue is this, is that we don't really know. I mean, we can't know.
Well, I guess those are
because you can't.
Anyway.
You just
can't.
It's a projection.
That's true.
And I think it's also fair to say that look, the unsecured southern border with almost nothing on it is clearly a possibility that it could be used as a.
And I don't think actually the Democrats are opposed to greater border security.
Exactly. Where I think the Minutemen go wrong or go sort of off the deep end is that they don't just say, look, it's a possibility. Many of them say, I know it's happening. I know it's happened at a huge level.
They can feel it in their gut.
They just, or what they actually do is they take examples that seem like it might have happened and extrapolate it into.
I don't think we know of a single example. Well, I can think of two from Canada way back when.
For example, John Culberson, the Texas congressman, was on Fox News, I think it was 2 years ago, on a bunch of stories saying they've caught terrorists from Iraq using the southern border, okay? And there was an AP story about it, and what ended up happening was, I can't remember the exact details, but they caught an illegal immigrant that they thought initially might have been from an Arab country and that wasn't, and that the sheriffs 2 weeks later in that town that Culberson was talking about said, no, it never happened. It's not true.
Was from Mexico.
He was from Mexico, exactly.
He just looked Arabic.
Right. I mean, but what's gone on is that nugget has been extrapolated
into
we know that they've crossed.
Let me ask you this. Apart from Lou Dobbs and the Minutemen, you're talking about the uprising. Is this new? I mean, we've had nativists in America. We've had opposition to illegal immigrants in America for decades and centuries. What's so new about now?
Well, I think what's new is that it's more intense now.
Why? Because we have bad economic times?
I think we have bad economic times in a recession right now, but I think more generally, I think people feel extremely, extremely helpless. I think they really believe that the government no longer works for them in any way
at all. So they're reaching out and looking for enemies.
So they're looking to take matters into their own hands. And as I say, my book is about the uprising on both the left and right.
Right. Now, why does this scare Wall Street? What is Wall Street afraid of?
Well, for instance, I mean, on the immigration issue, Wall Street wants a cheap source of exploitable labor.
Okay, that's true.
I think on the left side of what I've described in the uprising, a party I spent some time with the Working Families Party in New York State, which uses a system called fusion voting to exert a lot of influence in the legislature on behalf of labor unions and consumer groups.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the New York legislature is the legislature that is the jurisdiction of Wall Street.
Right.
So, for instance, one of the things that the Working Families Party has championed is a bill to raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires. There happen to be a lot of millionaire and billionaire Wall Street hedge fund managers in New York.
And that's one of the things they were working on, in fact, recently, the Democrats, in terms of the automatic minimum tax.
Yes,
they were talking about, and frankly, it seemed like most people supported making CEOs, pay the same rates as their waitresses.
That's exactly right. I spent some time. I went with a group of shareholder activists to the ExxonMobil shareholder meeting, and they ran a series of shareholder initiatives.
Now, why is it that those always lose?
Well, that's a great question. The reason why those always technically lose and they don't win the vote is because most of the holdings are in pension funds.
Well, why aren't the pension funds wanting to say that the CEO shouldn't get $500 million as he runs the company into the ground? Right. I can name a few examples
because,
of those.
Because the pension funds, the managers, there's two reasons. The managers have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profit for those funds.
Right.
Okay.
But if the CEO is running the company into the ground...
I agree. The burden, however... The burden is on the fund manager. The legal burden is on the fund manager to prove why they're voting against management.
Well, now that's interesting. The legal burden they have the. In other words, if they can't prove it, they've got to vote with management.
It's not exactly as crystal clear as that, but essentially what they fear is that they will be dragged into court by their owners. And
if they vote against
if
management?
If they vote against management. Because
why can't they be dragged into court if they vote for management? Michael Eisner earns $200 million as he runs Disney into the ground.
Because there's a third-party rating system. I know this is complex.
It's important to me. I've always wondered this.
There's a third-party rating system. It's not Moody's. It's called Institutional Shareholder Services, which advises, theoretically, objectively.
Tells pension funds how to vote their share.
How they should vote. And so most often... ISS, Institutional Shareholder Services, tells them to vote with management.
And that's because ISS...
Because management has the resources to prove its case...
To ISS.
To ISS as to why it's managing the company properly. Typically.
And those that think it's not managing properly, they should get to ISS.
Well, that's what happens. That's the campaign that is run in these shareholder campaigns. So that's the first problem.
Does ISS get any money from these companies?
No. No, but here's where it gets dicey. The second piece of this is that the pension fund managers and the mutual fund managers want to manage other pension funds.
Sure.
Okay. The CEOs of big companies
can recommend those.
Decide who manages their corporate pensions.
I see.
So
there's the rub.
So if I'm holding a pension,
I scratch your back, you scratch my back.
Exactly
I knew it had to be something like that.
So there's two things. But here's when I say technically win, this is an important point. A shareholder resolution is not about winning the vote. You want to win the vote. But what it's about is
scaring the managers.
Scaring the manager. The manager.
You win 15%, frightening.
Right. And the reason is because the management knows that every other shareholder knows how difficult it is, how impossible.
I want
it
you
is
to know.
Pass one.
I got a few shares of stock. For every single time I've owned a share of stock for the last 15 years, I always vote no to every... It's very easy how I vote. I vote no to every board of directors proposal and yes to every shareholder's proposal because I figure if they're reasonable, other people will vote like me and my vote will matter.
That's right.
And if they're not, no one will care anyway.
Well, this is why when a shareholder... When I was with the folks at ExxonMobil, their resolution got about 35%.
Wow.
And it was considered a huge win.
What was the resolution?
It was a resolution to force ExxonMobil to document how much of their total production was contributing to carbon emissions.
Okay.
And they made a very good business case. Remember, they don't come in and say, well, look, we need to save the world.
Right.
You know, it's all about how to make money. They said,
right.
Look, there's going to be regulation on carbon emissions. So it is a good business decision for us to start understanding how much we're at risk.
Sure.
So that later on we can know how much to adjust.
Right.
And, you know, it was very because you're going into the world's biggest oil company.
The most powerful corporation on Earth.
Most powerful corporation on Earth. And one study estimates that this is a company that has been responsible for 5% of all carbon emissions ever emitted in human history.
Wow.
So you're going into the belly of the beast here. And to get 35% is stunning.
So what does it mean at the end of the day? What are they going to do?
Well, what it means is that the hope is that management before the next year will come to the table and say, okay, we're going to implement some of what you want, more of what you want. They don't want these resolutions. It's embarrassing to them.
We have to wrap up here, and I know you've got other interviews. But the upshot of all of this, what works and what doesn't work? I mean, does the Minutemen work? Does Lou Dobbs work? Do these shareholder things work? How do you actually fight the power, if you will?
I think
What's the most successful way?
I think the shareholder resolutions have been very successful. And I think that the third party efforts to use fusion voting, and we didn't really get into that, but it's not a either or Ralph Nader / Green Party style third party. It's a hybrid third party that is allowed to work with sometimes one party and not work with the party. So I think that has worked very well.
Let me compare it, for example. I had a show yesterday. I had the woman from Code Pink on, and they do things. They disrupt congressional meetings, and they get arrested and things like that. Do those people actually affect change? Because my impression is the shareholders do a lot more than Code Pink.
I have a whole chapter on the anti-war movement, and I think that the anti-war movement is the most dysfunctional part of the uprising.
I agree.
And is not strategic.
I'm not attacking their aims. I'm just saying the way they go about it is not productive. It doesn't help.
I emphatically agree, and that is probably, at least for progressives, is going to be the most controversial chapter, because I also would also add that I don't necessarily even think that the MoveOns of the world,
I agree with you,
have done.
I think they've done a lousy
job.
They spent $800,000 on a 30-second ad in New York City when they could, sorry for the plug, support progressive radio for a lot less
money. I'll give you another example. We always talk about who's going to win the presidential election, who's going to win the congressional election. Right now, I think there are 12 or 15 states that have Democratic state legislatures and Democratic governors.
We need to gerrymander.
Why are we not focusing on passing major legislation through these? Why are we not focusing? Why are we always looking to Washington?
Absolutely.
It's incredible.
Not only that, but I would start some massive gerrymandering. If Tom DeLay could do it, we got to fight back. Fight power with power.
And you know what happened? The comparison is that Tom DeLay squeezed, what, seven new Republican seats out of Texas?
Right.
We had the opportunity to squeeze a bunch of new seats
out of
California.
What did we do?
We made our current Democrats just safer.
That's right. You and I agree on a lot of things.
We do.
Thanks, David, for coming on the Inside Scoop. I'll have you back for a full show sometime.
I'd love
like
to.
That.
Thanks for having me.